Okay, here we are again on Seeing Beneath the Surface. I'm Toni Quest, that's from TQ, and my co-host is Peter Elvidge. This is show number 23. I like the number 23. This show is really interesting, as all our shows are, but this show is dear to my heart. Our guest is dear to my heart as well. She is an animal behaviorist. Her name is Sonia Shelley Greeland. And the reason I thought she should be on our show, Seeing Beneath the Surface, is because she works with animals. And a couple of years, about 4 or 5 years ago, Shelley worked with me and my dog, who was suffering from PTSD because she fell down a very steep flight of hard stairs. And it took some time and some doing to get her to go down the stairs again. Where I live, there's basically one way out. For a dog, at least. So the only way she could get out of the apartment would be to go down those stairs. And after falling, she had, I guess, a conditioned response from the fall that couldn't even get her near the stairs. But Franja came and saved the day, and she was able to help me train my dog to go down the stairs again. So here we have Franja Greeland, Franja Shelley Greeland. Welcome to the show. Thank you, Sonia.
Hi, Toni. Hi, Peter. Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, so you have a really strong background in training animals. I don't know if I should use the word training, but conditioning animals. You have a way with them. You're like an animal whisperer, I would say. And I think that if it wasn't for you, my dog would not have gone down the stairs for the final 2 years of her life because of the trauma of falling down the stairs. The other thing I just want to tell the audience is my dog was a service dog. She was a very well-behaved, almost pathologically obedient service dog. She was a guide dog breeder. So she had the characteristics of a dog that can work with another person who had a disability. So tell the audience, our audience, a little bit more about your background, Shelley.
Okay.
I mean, Franja. I need to do that, Franja.
All right. I have a master's in animal behavior, and I am also a licensed pet care technician teacher by the New York State Education Department. I have, I'm a registered therapy animal handler and professional member of the Pet Professional Guild, which is a no-force, force-free professional association of dog trainers and other organizations like that. I've loved animals my whole life, but I really wanted to understand them in a formal way, to really understand how it was that they experienced the world. And I think that was one of the things that really motivated me to go back to graduate school and to get that training, that education, so I could really understand. And not just we love them, we think we're fascinated by them, but to understand the world the way that they perceive it. And once you start with that, the natural history of the animal, their behavior, that's then when you can kind of approach how to work with them. Whether it's behavior modification or whether it's training. I mean, what we're talking about really is learning. And all animals learn in very similar ways. And learning is something that's just basic to survival. You have to understand your environment. You have to understand how to navigate it, how to find mates, how to react to it. So when you're talking about something like the kind of trauma that you went through with Lillian, you were kind of fortunate in the sense that you knew what happened.
Yes, so I was there.
So the difference between animals and people when they go through this, the main difference, and there's different ways for treating post-traumatic stress disorder with individuals, is that mostly what we do is we can get that information from them, and there's all kinds of therapies where people will talk about it, or even these things that they'll do is so much controversial with rapid eye movements and, you know, following someone's finger while you're imagining the trauma. Now, you can't do that with an animal, right? So just kind of just work purely with desensitization, introducing the animal to this traumatic experience or scene of the traumatic experience mm-hmm. in little bits so as not to overcome them, and also counter conditioning them, give them things that are good, create new positive associations.
Right.
So I thank you for acknowledging that we were able to do that with Lillian, that I was able to bring that information to you. But as I said to you, you really, Tony, were present and available to do the work with her.
Yeah.
Because it's a process. You get this one trial learning, this severe reaction to a very aversive event because it's so dangerous, it's so traumatic,
yeah.
and it takes a long time to back away from that. Even with people, we know that this lasts for a year. And these are just, you know, some of the reports that people are giving. We don't even know
yeah.
with all of the events how long, how every part of it can last. So you can do work with them, with people, with animals, but you have to actually be able to do it. So when I came and I talked to you about this and I sat and I went and I worked with you guys, you were the one who really did the heavy lifting in sitting on the stairs with her, you know, having a glass
yeah.
of wine, going closer in increments, inch by inch, making it not so scary. If you hadn't put the time in and the work in, there was no way that Lillian was going to be able to get to those stairs.
Right.
Because it's that we have to do as a process. We can't just talk about it. You actually have to put the time in and doing it.
Mm-hmm. I have to use my mind. I mean, you said having a glass of wine. Lillian didn't have a glass of wine. The dog didn't have one. I did. We turned it into like a, I don't know if she would have turned it down. We turned the area into a social area. So when friends would come over, you know, there's a chair there, a couple of chairs, put a table out there, and we'd sit, and we'd have a little social time out, you know. We'd sit on the top of the stairs watching her very carefully to make sure it wouldn't happen again. But we sat there, and so she started to, as you had trained me to do or reinforce this in me, is to turn the area into a happy place.
And what you did, too, is now you have this landing, but you started in the hallway. So that's the idea, too, is you start far enough away from
mm-hmm.
wherever the trigger is, far enough away for wherever that stimulus is going to evoke this kind of fear response, that you're
mm-hmm.
not getting that. If they can be within sight of it, but they still are at a comfortable distance, and then you move closer and closer. So if you remember, you started kind of in the doorway and then moved your chair,
yeah.
your time out there in,
mm-hmm.
in these steps closer and closer to that landing area, so it became less and less scary, and you build up this positive association, this bank of good associations to kind of cancel out, and little by little, almost like it's this huge ladder that you get to climb with good stuff, good stuff, good stuff, good stuff, until
mm-hmm.
you get enough security that you can approach it.
Right, and the better, and the thing that was interesting, and I know I was listening and watched the video again. You made the treats like something that it's okay for her to have. You
yeah.
know, I mean, normally I would not overfeed her treats like that, but it was a happy time for her. She liked that, and so
mm-hmm.
she knew the closer she got, the better the treat became.
But you have to make it meaningful. You have to make it what we call salient, right? It has to be important. Otherwise,
mm-hmm.
How are you building something that's positive? It has to,
right.
So you've got to be able to do the kind. And when people who are concerned about with treats, you can almost feed part of the diet that way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So just give less of the meal so you're not. And then the other thing, too, people will sometimes say, well, if I'm giving treats, this is the only reason the dog is going to be doing this. They're
well,
not
yeah.
really.
That's right.
But they're not really, it doesn't really work that way necessarily. They're not putting, it's not that they couldn't figure that out eventually. And that is almost why, when it comes to actually looking for repeated behaviors, this intermittent reinforcement schedule is almost like the best way to get to really proof a behavior, because if you never know when you're going to get rewarded, you're going to keep trying just as hard, you know, for something as you would, and you may not try as hard for that if you knew you were getting rewarded all the time, almost like, which almost goes against the concept of like weekly paycheck, you know. You really should, really seriously, if you never know when you're getting, work a lot harder. But with something like with desensitization and counter conditioning, what you're really trying to do is is create those positive associations. And remember, you're dealing with an atmosphere that is so charged with whether it's trauma or fear or negative emotion that you really need to have something to cancel some of that stuff out with. So it's not this I'm working for something, you know, quid pro quo kind of thing. It's you're trying to take the edge off of.
Right. And it did work, you know. I just want to tell the audience it worked because, you know, it was unusual for my dog to not do what I asked. She's never been corporally trained, which means she's never so much as had a rolled up newspaper, you know, little knock on the nose. She's never, ever been, like, trained in that way at all. It was always reward and reinforcement or something?
It's request, and then, so request reward.
Yeah.
So you ask her for the behavior, she gives it to you, and then you would reinforce her.
Right.
Whether it's praise or...
Praise and reward. That was the way she was trained. And she was trained that way before I got her. She came to me that way. She was trained by someone else from 9 weeks old to 16 months because the intention was that this puppy would be working as a guide dog. But she tested higher than that because the organization, Guiding Eyes for the Blind, they take the top 2 percentile and they become guide dogs, and the top 1 percentile become breeders. And my understanding is that most of the dogs that they breed do not make the cut. It's a very small percentage. Lillian made the cut. People thought she was rejected because she didn't become a guide dog. But what had actually happened is she tested so well in behavior and just basic, her inherent characteristics were so strong that they decided, which is what they do, is reproduce that genetic, that reproduce those genes, you know, so they can always have the best dog. But she ended up being, you know, foster and then, a breeder, you know, for, I think, 3 years, you know, so for her to disobey, and I didn't ask, I always wanted to ask you this, Tanya, for her to not go down the stairs when I asked her to go down, I'm wondering, how does that translate in her mind that she knows that she's disobeying me, but she's so scared that she breaks a code that was so locked into her, you know, to just, you know, she'd say her name and she'd be on the alert to do something. That's how trained she was.
And that's a great question. There's something called a hierarchy of needs, and you see this with a, with Maslow. Maslow is the name of the researcher who started with this, and what you have to have is safety. And there can be any response to anything, the organism has to feel safe. They have to be stable. So Lillian at that point was so scared for her own safety that she could not respond. And this is something that is built into every organism. If we didn't have that, it would be deleterious to us just as beings, right? We've got to preserve ourselves first. We have to. That's just how we're all biologically wired.
Right.
So if you feel that threatened, they can't respond. They're impossible. What starts to happen is you have all kinds of hormones that start to, you know, stress hormones, adrenaline, adrenaline, cortisol, whatever it is that's going through mm-hmm. the body at that time, prevents the animal, right, from moving at that point. And that's also one of the reasons why when you have that, when you've got stress like this,
mm-hmm.
you can't teach, you can't train, and the animal can't learn. It is impossible. So
right.
you have to, and also, P.S., by the way, one of the reasons why when you start with behavior modification, the very first tenet and the first rule is you are supposed to remove all punishment. Because you can't, punishment causes stress, it's anxiety,
mm-hmm.
floods, all these neurotransmitters start going in the brain with all the wrong things and the animal can't learn, whether it's human or non-human animal. So, and P.S., by the way, Tony, and I know you mentioned it, but the work that we did, I put a video up on my YouTube channel of this, so you actually get to see the process
yeah.
where people who have had this kind of a similar situation where they have trauma like this, they can kind of look at that and see how we did that together mm-hmm. and how you were able to work through it with her. But so for her at that, to go back to Lillian saying no to you, it was more just this frozen, I can't move. She's not responding to you. And so
right.
also a thing, when you
sure.
see an animal that is there, that is scared, or a dog that's really scared, when a dog won't take treats, you know, we talk about taking treats, there,
mm-hmm.
you could have offered her, like, a huge donut at that point, you know,
yeah.
cookie, whatever it was, which her favorite, Cheeto, whatever was her favorite thing, and she
mm-hmm.
would not have taken it. Because when you go back to that hierarchy of needs, food now is not important. I need to feel safe. So that's always a, yep, to look at. If they're not taking treats and they are really scared.
Right. This is true. I really can say that just having been there, I'm actually reliving it because I won't talk about what happened, you know, but she's, unfortunately, Lillian passed away 3 years ago. But she was going down, up and down the stairs pretty freely. The main problem she had, you'll notice in the video, I'll say this to the audience, that she's wearing a harness because she's an old dog. She was an old dog at that point with hip dysplasia. So it was hard enough that I had to kind of literally lift half of her weight to go up and down the stairs, which I managed that with the harness. But now that she didn't want to go at all, I wasn't able to pick up the whole 66 pounds. I'm not strong enough for that. I'm pretty strong, but not strong enough to carry 66 pounds of dog up and down the stairs. So, you know, she had gone through a few things and adapted to it. But the fall down the stairs, that was just, the vet said even she'll never go down the stairs again. And I thought to myself, I'll see about that. And I thought about you, Franya, when he said that. He said she'll never. He said she'll never. That's what he said. He was wrong, by the way. Just imagine seeing your pet, and she's 67 pounds, you know, tumbling down the stairs and landing on her stomach and just laying there. The other thing I want to say, which was interesting about my dog, is that she fell down the stairs and not a whimper. She was down, you know. She didn't get up right away. I didn't let her. And she never cried. She never whimpered. She was so obedient that I wonder sometimes it's too obedient. It might be to her detriment. I wonder
right.
sometimes. You know, I don't know. But she had to be that way. And I thought about it a lot, not recently until today. What if, and I'll ask you this, Peter, what if a blind person has a dog, and the dog and the guide dog falls down the stairs and gets traumatized and won't go up and down anymore? What do they do with that dog? And what is that, what happens to the person, the partner?
Well, I can actually say on that aspect, and I also can flip it on its head on another aspect as well. So starting out with, like, you know, I mean, having your guide or companion, whichever your preference of a title for your dog is, usually it's guide, but I'm just putting that out there. You know, I've seen where, like, you know, people are out and about, you know, who have blindness or low vision, who have guides, and they'd be walking across the street, and what the all-time traumatic event that most of them encounter, you know, whether it be dog or human, is traffic and crossing the street. And one of the major things that a lot of programs, at least from what I've seen from friends of mine, that, like, let's say if they're getting to know each other, or maybe they've gone through that learning process and are working with each other, but actively something like that happened. In an interesting way, if the experience is both of them, because most of the time with those traumatic experiences, it would be both the person and their guide, you know, it actually helps out because they both can reinforce each other, you know, and make each other feel safe. And the, I think the difficult thing in that situation is getting back out there, particularly for crossing streets and things. It's a mindset that you just kind of have to not only work with yourself, but you have to, you know, work with your guide. You know what I mean? Because they're your friend. You know, they experienced it just like, you know, like you did. You know, they're trying to protect you. You're trying to protect them. You know, it's something that's interesting. But in the instance of, like, you know, like falling downstairs or anything a little bit more, I guess I would, you know, I don't want to say out of the normal, but just, I mean, like out of the normal situations that I would consider traumatic events for a guide, for someone with blindness or visual impairment, I would say that, you know, pretty much like you did, you know, is like a good strategy for those with blindness or visual impairment, you know. However, I will say is that if you have something in that type of scenario where, you know, where your guide is having a little bit of trouble going downstairs, things like that, I would recommend on, like, marking, you know, where the steps are or something, just for your personal safety as well. That's a little bit
of a
custom.
I mean, if you're the visually impaired person.
Yeah. If you have blindness or visual impairment, I would definitely recommend kind of having a particular marker, just particularly for yourself, you know, because we don't want you to be injured on top of, you know, trying to help your guide get back to his full self or her full self. Because it's really important and I think this is that for those with blindness or visual impairment, they have kind of a custom sense to their guides, because they're both trying to do the same things for each other, and in a lot of ways, you know, your guide can do more things than you can, and in a lot of ways, you can do more things than your guide.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, to understand that, you know, when you have a guide dog in general, it's very important that not only do they take very important care of you, but you got to take very important care of them, and, you know, and work with them. And in this particular situation, like you said, you know, understand, you know, safety is the key. Start out with safety and continue, you know, in very small steps, whatever they might be, in a very positive and progressional manner. And the other thing that I wanted to kind of state is, like, flipping on its head in that scenario is where, like, a friend of mine who, you know, he was getting to learning, you know, crossing the streets, things like that, getting used to traveling on his own for mobility. And this was, like, you know, after a little bit of pre-training with his guide, you know, he got to know him, you know, started working with him, things like that. And what happened was is that he and his guide were walking out. You know that there is definitely quiet cars in the world. They're so quiet, you know, not everybody can hear them. And what happened is that this car ran a red light, and unfortunately the dag managed to get out of the way, but my friend, he got his leg under the car and had to have surgery to fix it. But he had that opposite traumatic experience where his dog was actually, you know, trying to get him out. Of course, you know, there was programs and things he was going through at the same time, but what they did is that they had him, after, you know, having, like, physical therapy for his injuries, you know, they would have him, you know, go and, you know, cross one street, so to speak, for a certain destination he liked to go to or something that they both enjoyed at the same time, and then continuously progressed from there. And their, like, ultimate goal was, like, you know, something across town, so to speak, right?
Yeah.
And the idea was that when they got to that point, you know, where they were going across town, so to speak, to that location. Like they would either choose like a place just beyond it or just, you know, over the streets or whatever it is. So that when they got there, you know, it'd be like, you know, hey, you went past going across town. And, you know, it's not only an accomplishment for the person, but it's also an accomplishment for the guide. And, you know, no matter who you are, we all experience, you know, the rough times and definitely can experience PTSD. But, you know, the amount of time and the amount of energy and the amount of care that you put in, whether you're an animal friend or you're a human friend, you know, is important to everyone.
Did you find that in this particular case, it sounds like, from what I could discern from what you were just saying, is that the guide did not have as much trauma as the actual visually impaired person. It was a human partner that had more trauma.
But you know what, Kenneth? I wonder though if we can say that. I mean, because we obviously don't know what's going on in the mind of anyone, human, but certainly not with an animal. But when you're taking a guide or a service dog or these animals which are trained to assist, that's the first things that they're asked to present. So that animal, almost to the point of what you were talking about with Lillian, where that's the first thing they're going to give is this assistance. So even more so when you talk about working through a trauma, you can't really tell if they're traumatized because that's not what they have been trained to show. They have been trained to first help. So we don't see that. So this is what's very difficult, and that's why you really have to kind of look at the whole rest of what's going on with that animal. Do you have what we call displacement behaviors, right? Is this animal stressed, and then it's coming out in different ways because it can't show it in this particular way?
Right.
And almost in a way, so when you're working through, you talked about taking these walks together, I would think that the guide would need even more reinforcement, even more reward, even more encouragement, because not only is it being asked to assist and to do a job, but you're also asking to work through individual trauma. So it's a double hard, you know, duty that they have to carry out there with maybe not, you know, enough of the requisite social support that they would get. Do you hear what I'm saying with that?
Yeah.
Because we can't, we're not really seeing the emotional toll, you know. We've trained them not to show it.
We're seeing a trained dog that has that is trained to respond a certain way. I think that what I felt bad for with my dog is that she was so trained that if she couldn't fulfill my wishes, you know, if I said, you know, I said, come on, Lillian, let's go for a walk, you know. She couldn't fulfill my wishes, and she couldn't go past the threshold of the door. That in itself made her feel as if she was just like a bad dog.
Absolutely.
You know,
ashamed.
It was double stress on that poor dog. It's true.
Yeah.
I mean, we owe these animals so much. I always say we would not have civilization as we know it without the dog. I mean, they helped early man. They helped with farming and traveling and the work that we in shepherds, you couldn't have, like, people had 300 sheep and one dog, you know, was taking care of, working with them. So they really are just huge, huge game changers for us and really co-evolve with us. When you think about, talk about dogs whose primary sense is the sense of smell, right? That's how they see the world, and we're visual. We're primates. That's how they look at us. They co-evolve so that they make eye contact with us. Wolves don't do that, you know. Dogs do, because they figured us out. We can't smell the way that they can, but they can certainly you know, track visually with us. So it's pretty amazing. And when you also think the other thing is that we kind of control it, you know? I mean, I was mm-hmm. saying this earlier, Tony, when they're going to go to the bathroom, where
right.
are they going to, who they get to play with, do they get to mate, do they not get to mate, what are they going
right.
to eat? You are in control of everything.
Everything of that dog, everything.
I suffered from PTSD from a trauma once,
one trauma in particular I'm thinking about. And there were certain things I didn't realize were characteristic, but I learned that they were, you know, and there's a certain response that happens with a human being, just like with a dog, I imagine, that every time you hear that noise, I did a show on someone else's podcast about 2 weeks ago, Professor Pamela Williams, and she did a 3-part series, and she had me on and some other people to talk about how the arts are used to help intervene, I'll say intervene with PTSD and the symptoms of. So with dogs, it's basically just doing the same thing over and over again, it sounds like, to sort of undo what has happened. That's just my layman's terms for dogs and PTSD. I mean, what do you think about that, Sonia?
I totally agree that you're going to, when you talk about clinical signs, when you talk about symptoms, you can identify it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think to know where this is coming from or how it happens, it's a much harder thing when it comes with animals as opposed to humans. And let me talk to you about, like, let's say you have a dog that is terribly afraid of thunderstorms.
Yeah.
Now that may not have anything to do with PTSD. They may just have a fear of thunderstorms. Maybe they don't like, and there's a lot of different thoughts on to why they could be having this fear.
Mm-hmm.
But then you have the one that is reacting to that sound because maybe it's evocative of noises that they connect with, that maybe they were gone. And I actually have had several dogs that I've worked with where there have had situations where there have been gunshots and
yeah.
things like, you know, come from certain sorts of trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And but the problem too with this when it comes to that is, all right, fine, it's a gunshot, but is it a gunshot in the summer, you know, in a city, or is it in a field? It becomes very, it can be very context specific
yeah.
for what reacting to. So it's much harder because we don't have the language to tease it out of why. And
yeah.
so when you're trying to treat it, when you're saying, okay, how do I do this? You kind of have one of the things with people
mm-hmm.
work with is relaxation therapy, right? With PTSD.
Yeah.
Well, you can do that same treatment with animals with the dog, and specifically, you know, Karen Overall, who's really great and who is one of the foremost, you know, veterinary psychiatrists in the or behaviorists in the country,
mm-hmm.
worked up with this, where you literally kind of you watch the dog. It's kind of like you're just basically really focusing on their breathing, and when they start to, even around a stressful situation, when they start to exhale, you kind of reward that and you work with them on that. So you can almost do this
mm-hmm.
kind of relaxation protocol with them. But it's harder to do it. You have to be more very sensitive, and you have to work on a more granular level, because we can't talk to them about
yeah.
what is specifically, when does it really bother you, you know, kind of a thing.
Yeah, we tend to anthropomorphize, is that the word, with our animals? We
sure.
assign them these human characteristics, because we tend to talk to them a certain way. You sort of talk in a baby talk way to most dogs, you know, or like in a buddy talk way, you know, to most dogs, you know. And so we just sort of assign them our own characteristics, when it might be incorrect, not that it's wrong, but it's like you're inaccurate, it's not accurate, it's not factual, it's not
well,
real.
Yeah. Not if, and then I do the if you real, if, I mean, veterinarians will do this, behaviorists do this too.
Mm-hmm.
You we are, as organisms, again, we share emotions, we have different
mm-hmm.
ways of expressing them, different senses, but
mm-hmm.
certainly if we are informed enough, and if we take the time enough to learn about the natural history of that animal, that biology of that animal, we can infer that they are in fact happy or
yeah.
sad, or, you know, I mean, the one thing that we are probably the most guilty of is that guilty look thing, you know.
Yeah.
we We say, oh, that dog. And what it really is it's appeasement behavior. You know, you come home and you're like, what did you do wrong? And then the dog, like, starts to, like, kind of give you this look. It's not that they're guilty. It's just that they would like you not to yell at them, you know, kind of thing.
Yes. Real life should not be yelled at. Peter, I want to talk to you, Pete, about, because Fonda had said something to me off the air about that she admired the fact. We did our show on Cane versus Canine. She told me she admired the fact that you were sensitive enough to realize, as nice as it is to have a nice, beautiful dog to snuggle up with and to just have a little pal there, that you said that you have more freedom with the cane because you acknowledged the fact that you would have to give attention to the canine, you know? And so I think it's commendable that you would be that mindful.
Yeah, well, I mean, so this is something, like, that I found out, you know, not only from asking questions but being exposed to the programs. And this is a lot of things that a lot of, like, you know, younger students do that go through blindness visual parent training. And, you know, they always ask, you know, which do you think you would prefer? You know, would you prefer using a cane or would you prefer having a guide? And, you know, a lot of students will be like, you know, oh, I would love a guide. But the thing is that they don't realize when they kind of make that decision, they don't realize, you know, what does that mean to have a guide, you know, I mean, because they're not only going to be your friend, but they, you know, you have to take care of them, you know, there's responsibilities, there's also different types of, you know, of behavioral type things with your, you know, your life's routine, because, I mean, if you think of it this way, and being that I'm a very mobile person, and saying, you know, I'm not saying that someone with a guide isn't, but I'm a very mobile person and I'm a very, you know, I just like to kind of go out the door. Versus, I mean, you have guides and you have your dog with you, and you have to take into consideration, the weather or how they're feeling, you know, or there's all sorts of different aspects that need to be, analyzed. That's not to say that it's a bad thing. It's just that, a lot of the responsibilities and a lot of the, you know, requirements or, the requirements, responsibilities, this doesn't sound right, but I mean, to understand that there is a different type of lifestyle that you need to understand with having a companion or a guide with you, is so crucial and so important versus having a white cane. For me, you know, like I said, I'm just an up and going out in the world type person. You know, I love dogs, completely, because I have friends who have them. But I'm just, you know, I feel that my abilities would be more, you know, wrapped around the capability of using my cane. And, you know, there's different aspects. Depends on your personality and your different lifestyle. So, you know.
It's funny, I had never considered it until I met you. I never considered, I assumed that people would rather have a dog, you know, until I met you, and you explained to me why they might not, and I never thought about it. It's more responsibility. You can't just sleep until 9 a.m. or 10 a.m. or whatever, because you have to get up and you have to tend to that animal. It has to be done, you know?
Yeah.
It's a responsibility.
Yeah, because they're there to take care of you, and you are there to take care of them. I mean, it's a give and take relationship, definitely, when it comes to having guides or service dogs of any kind. When we're thinking about, like, the, you know, issues that dogs can have, particularly with, like, PTSD and things, that bond is so crucial, particularly in those instances, because, you know, you have to have a well-established bond, you know, otherwise it's going to be a little bit more difficult or a lot more difficult, depending on, to getting over some of those struggles, whether they be personal in the human aspect or personal in the guides aspect. So
Peter, I think, I mean, you're absolutely 100% right in that there can be wonderful, wonderful pairings there. The other part of the guide, service dog thing is that it's also a very high, if you look at the studies, very high attrition rate, where a lot of these
yeah.
animals that are placed with a person, the union doesn't last. And I wonder, you know, and I think I was mentioning this to Tony. There's a study mm-hmm. that they were, pilot study they were doing out of England, trying to find out, like you talk about Lillian, they breed these dogs to find, which we want to find, they have the right temperament, they have the right, you know, physical attributes. Let's just try to continue them. So they were looking mm-hmm. at all these, what could we do, you know, with what breed do they come from, what breeder, which location, what can we do so that we can keep these dogs with the people longer? And when I
yeah.
looked at this, my first comment was, why aren't you looking at how the handler is trained? What is the process that they go through? There's a,
mm-hmm.
you know, what about, how does this work? There's a great movie that I used to show to my students called Quill, and it's a Japanese film about service dogs. And they'd show this facility where the people would have to go and, like, live for, like, 6 months.
They have that in Westchester County in Yorktown. They call it the training center, and it's really training the people. And it's 6 months or maybe more that they're there.
So it's a tremendous amount of work for the human that's involved in it,
yeah.
too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I think sometimes they will do it for the protection. Some people, I imagine, I don't know that much. I'm not with the organization anymore. But I know Lillian and I were ambassadors. But I remember that some of the trained people being trained to have a dog, I could see that the reason they had the dog sometimes was because it's a woman, you know, that has this dog that looks kind of fierce in some cases.
Yeah.
German Shepherds, you know, we have those.
Yeah, in those cases too, because I've definitely, you know, like I said, when people are deciding whether a cane or canine is best for them,
mm-hmm.
that's one of the things that I've heard about before. Is, you know, people are like, you know, I'm looking for a way of feeling comfortable or protected. That's one of the deciding factors is, can you coincide, you know, your protection or your feelings or whatever those things are that you personally, you know, just kind of dealing with or trying to figure out in your life.
Mm-hmm.
Can you have those coincide with the responsibilities of taking care of a guide? And like you said too, it's important because, like, you know, the guides have certain, you know, like, you know, diets, you know, there's different types
yeah.
of routines. There's
mm-hmm.
all sorts of different things. And, you know, a lot of people, like, when they're first thinking about, you know, and I've heard this from other students, you know, they think about having a cane or a guide, and they're like, you know, oh, you know, I should have a really big dog, you know, because then they can protect me and things like that. And it's like, well, but they're not there, you know, to, you know, so to speak, be your bodyguard. I mean, if they need to, they can, but,
that's
you know,
a different kind of a dog. That's a different kind of service dog. That's there.
Yeah.
When you say
yeah.
Tanya, this is a different kind of training and everything, isn't it?
But I would imagine, yes. When you say protect, though, I mean, that kind of, what are we talking about, though, in that regard? Because you certainly don't want to train an animal to be aggressive around other people, right? That would be bad. So,
yeah. Well,
kind of.
What I mean by, like, protect is kind of like, how do I put this? Like, whether you're putting yourself in, you know, unsafe scenarios and then, you know, assuming that the dog will take over and protect you or have this idea that, you know, in whatever instance
people,
there is,
people would
you know,
be afraid.
That's almost a natural thing that a dog will do, even without having to be, you don't really, if someone menaced you or got too close or got in your
oh,
face,
yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Any is that is to the human is going to be protective of that scenario.
Mm-hmm.
I had somebody call me now, over the summer. They had this really sweet German Shepherd puppy. Dog was big 5 months, and you forget that they are puppies when they, because they get so big, some of these, you know, giant breeds. But
mm-hmm.
the woman who called me said to me, the dog is too nice. She wanted, him and had, she wanted the dog to be, and I said, what do you, she said, she'll let anybody pet her. I said, there's nothing wrong with that. You don't, we don't want to train an animal to be, you know, aggressive or growling, because this is, then we're creating a dangerous dog that is going to be hypervigilant and, you know, want to, like, eat everyone. That's, we don't want Cujo, you know?
You know, I was curious of one more thing, too, while we were thinking about, like, getting, like working with your guide or your dog or, you know, even just your companion as a pet. You know, when you kind of experience those events where you have, you know, the residual PTSD afterwards, and you're kind of going through the processes of, like, you know, getting back to whatever, you know, particular thing or goal you're trying to achieve, you mentioned kind of having, like, different types of therapies. And I thought to myself, like one of the things that I do, you know, obviously is because of my routine, is I'm an artist. And one of the things I did when I was dealing with the changes in my vision, because my vision's been changing for, like, the last 7 years due to a couple of conditions. You know, is there kind of like a equivalent, you know, so to speak, you know, not necessarily art, but, like, you know, some other types of ideas for some pet owners who might be going through this, who are looking for, like, different ideas that, you know, are, like, relaxing or kind of, like, push them, so to speak, out of their comfort zones of being kind of, like, you know, quiet or in their house or things like that?
So there are different things that you can do. So you talk, once you've gotten past, you know, desensitization or counter conditioning, so the animal's no longer highly reactive around a traumatic event or area, yes, play is great. You know, and play is actually, so interactive play, and there's different kinds of games that you can play with them, but as long as it's interactive, whether it's tug of war or throwing something for them, or, I mean, a lot of working dogs are rewarded and find much greater reward with play as opposed to treats. They're way more motivated by that.
Yeah.
You know, scent detection dogs, that's a very powerful thing for them. There's all kinds of things which people will do just for fun, which the dogs love doing too, which is that kind of scent detection work or agility. But basically what you're talking about is interacting with them in this fun, meaningful way. Because what we tend to do is, you know, we go for a walk, we pet them, but how much interaction are we doing? And that's why training too, if it's done in a very rewarding, reinforcing way, can be powerful. Enriching for the animal.
They love the praise. I find that they love the praise. They love that. Like, I loved it.
They absolutely do, and they love that it's coming from you and that you're saying their name and that you're interacting with them. So there are so many ways that you can interact with them in a positive way, and that's really what it comes down to. And certainly, too, even just the touching, you know, petting on the chest, petting them the right way, rubbing their, you know, ear strokes. And there's so many things that you can do with your dog that are rewarding. But what's nice about play is that it, again, generates all these wonderful chemicals and changes in our brain that are good, that get us from a place of anxiety or worry to a place where we've got other things going on that are beneficial for us.
I think it's interesting because I had an interesting experience with my dog, because at first she was definitely a working dog, and she was a foster in foster care with my late husband and I. And it was sort of interesting to me that how she transitioned into a therapy dog for him when he had become sick. She somehow knew what he needed from her, you know,
right.
And the hospital would let her come in and she would jump on the bed and they would say anything. Then she'd hang with him and then instinctively she would jump off the bed, you know, and she'd go around in this oncology unit and she'd go from room to room and she'd stay in each room for a certain amount of time. Then she'd go to the next room, and then she'd go back to her daddy, and she'd hang with him. I always thought that was very interesting. I'm not really versed in how dogs are. I know I'm probably more about training them than most people because she was a service dog, and I had to be very astute about her training. But it was interesting to me how she somehow knew what the needs of people were, you know? I never really quite got a grip on that. Why is that?
Well, they are very in tune with us. I mean, they've studied us. Again, they've really learned so much about humans. They're very sensitive. This is one of the big things in their coevolution with us.
Mm-hmm.
They're also we're important to them. So
yeah.
They're keyed into not just what our body language is telling them, but we know that a lot of dogs now, you talk about different kinds of service dogs and different
mm-hmm.
kinds of things that dogs can do for people, but you've got dogs that that can detect a seizure. We don't know how they do it. Are they doing it because probably it has something to do that we may smell different
right.
When seizures are coming on. Maybe it has to – dogs certainly – they – actually see things faster than we do. There's the way we process visual information is called flicker fusion, that goes from the optic nerve to the brain, and the dog actually sees things faster than humans does. It's one of the reasons why a dog, before you had digital television, was never interested in analog TV, because it would literally see like one frame at a time. So when
yeah.
you throw a frisbee, the dog sees it going across the field faster than we do. So we don't really know so much, like how they know so much of the things that they do, because it's very difficult to devise tests to measure senses that we don't really fully understand ourselves.
Right.
But they are certainly, when it comes to people who, one of the great uses of therapy dogs or hospice dogs, they have a sensitivity definitely to people that are ill. I mean, to us, even
mm-hmm.
when if you have a dog and you've ever started crying, what's the first
yeah.
thing the dog comes over and they start like kissing you?
They come kissing you, pawing at you. They just want you to be happy. I just had like one thing. I wanted to thank Franya, but I just want to say one thing. I have to say it. When I was a kid growing up, a child, very little kid, I had what they call zoophobia. I was afraid
right.
of dogs. I was deathly afraid of dogs. And my mother was walking me down the street. She'd have to cross the street if I heard dog barking or if I saw one. I was so terrified. And then my grandmother asked me, because my mother died, my grandmother asked me, my father, why is Tony so afraid of dogs? And he said, because when I was very little, maybe two, he would walk me around and show me off to people. He saw a dog, that it was a nice dog. He put me on the floor, on the ground, to pet the dog, and the dog jumped on me, knocked me down, and I just was, like, terrified. And look, it took years. Well, not really. It took maybe 12 years, because then I got a dog. The family got a dog, a Labrador mix, which created that. I just had to say that.
That dog liked you. Jumping on it is a natural greeting behavior for dogs. I mean, that's what dogs do. They jump on each other, right?
Right.
We get
I was 2 years old. It knocked
you were
me down.
And that's not what humans do, but that's what dogs
do. That's what dogs
kind of do. Thing.
Gotcha. Yeah, well, I greatly appreciate you being on tonight. Where can we find you guys
Thank
at?
Thank you for having
me. Yeah. Where can we find you guys at? Social media, website, anything like that? What are you doing currently?
Sonia, I know you're all over the net, so tell us where we can find you on the internet.
Okay, so you can go to my website, and on my website I have all kinds of articles and information about behavior and training for cats and dogs, and also I've got stuff on there about urban wildlife. My website is animalbehaviorist, and I'm going to spell it A-N-I-M-A-L, behaviorist, B-E-H-A-V-I-O-R-I-S-T, .us. So animalbehaviorist.us, And you can also find me on YouTube. I've got tons of videos on there as well. Look for, again, animalbehaviorist.us. I'm on Facebook, animalbehaviorist.us Facebook page, and or just Google me, Franya Shelley Grelin, and you'll find all of that.
That's F-R-S like Frank, R-A-N-I-A.
Right, Franya, and then Shelley, S-H-E-L-L-E-Y, hyphen Grelin, G-R-I-E-L-E-N.
Thank you, Franya.
Great.
This is really great. You liked it, right? You liked this one, right, Pete? This is a good interview.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Most definitely.
Cool.
And like I said, we're going to have you on another segment in the future, so be on the lookout for our email so we can chat again, because this would be awesome.
I'd love to come back.
All right. Awesome. All right. And, Tony, where can we find you, as usual? Social media, all that great different places. I can't speak today.
You can find me at ScreamingWoman.com, ScreamingWoman, that's one woman, .com. You can also find me on LinkedIn.com. I write a lot of articles on LinkedIn, and I try to do things that are relevant to many things, mostly business, art, culture, science. You know, I'm hoping I could get, well, anyway, I won't say this, a guest I would love to have on the show. One day he'll be on it. But I think that this show is really great, Bonnie. Thank you. And coming soon to a computer near you will be energystonersjewelry.com. It's being built as we speak. And as soon as it's up, I'll let everybody know all about it. Thank you so much, Bonnie, for being on the show. And Peter, what's up?
Yeah, so like usual, guys, you can find me a lot of different places on the internet. Find me at Twitter at Peter Elvidge, PeterElvidge. All one word. You can find me as connected to the Perseverance Network. You can also find this podcast on iTunes, on Google Play, iHeartRadio, all those great different places where it's syndicated in multiple different networks. And we are growing every day, and we appreciate you guys so very, very much for being on the show, and appreciate the audience so very, very much for being here with us. And I know that everyone is going to tune in to the next Seeing Beneath the Surface, because episode 24 is going to be awesome. But I thank you guys so very, very much for being a part of episode 23 of Seeing Beneath the Surface. Thank you, guys, and have a nice night.
Good night.